Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive of the RSA. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all to today's event and to introduce you to our distinguished guest speaker, Cass Sunstein. It's no exaggeration to say that Cass is one of the most influential scholars at work in the world today, exploring fundamental questions of human freedom, agency, and progress with insights from the fields of psychology, philosophy, economics, and the law. Currently university professor at Harvard Law School, Cass was administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the Obama administration and was the recipient of the 2018 Holberg Prize, one of the largest international prizes awarded to scholars who have made outstanding contributions to research in the humanities and social sciences. Cass is the author of several acclaimed books, including the hugely influential, not one of the most influential books that's been published in the last 20 or 30 years. Its full title was Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth and Happiness, which he co-authored with Richard Thaler. He speaks today sharing insights from two new books on freedom and how change happens, in which he explores the many ways that change can take effect at both individual and social scale, ranging from gradual nudges to growing movements to sudden cascades. It's a topic that we're hugely interested in here at the RSA and what we spend our days and nights working on. For us, the challenge is not to generate more content, more great ideas, but to think deeply about what it is that really drives change, what's holding us back. So what Cass is going to talk about is fascinating to us and of great interest also to our fellows, many of whom are change makers themselves. So it's a great privilege to hear from Cass today. I'm looking forward to the conversation that we're going to have and to the thoughts and comments that I'm sure you're going to contribute.
Thank you all. It's a great pleasure as well as an honor to be here. I have a large topic, which is how social change happens. And I'd like to start with a quotation quite recent from a computer programmer from Syria who says, "When you meet somebody coming out of Syria for the first time, you start to hear the same sentences, that everything is okay. It'll take like 6 months up to 1 year to become a normal human being, for him to say what he thinks, what he feels. Then he might start whispering. He won't speak loudly." Much of what I have to say is captured in that passage. I'm going to tell you a tale that relates to my larger themes that isn't a quotation, but that's research from Saudi Arabia. The background is that by custom in Saudi Arabia, women aren't in the labor force unless their husbands say it's okay. In the research, it was found that young Saudi men believe overwhelmingly that it's completely fine if their wives are working. That is their private judgment. At the same time, young Saudi men believe that other young Saudi men think it's not at all fine if their wives are working. Their private judgment departs from their assessment of what the social norm is. In the experiment, Saudi men, young men, were told, actually, most people like you think it's completely fine if wives are working in the labor force. What happened then, do you think? Social change. When young Saudi men were informed of what other young Saudi men actually think, they started saying publicly, including to their spouses, please go work, and job applications skyrocketed. The Saudi research and the Syrian quotation are the same. They're stories of social change coming either in a hurry or slowly as a result of an unleashing of private judgment, unleashing which comes from the softening of social norms. That's going to be my major theme, and I'm hoping that the analysis is going to tell us something about civil rights movements in general, about the rise of fascism in the 1930s, about contemporary populism, about Brexit, and about movements that are barely on the horizon. To vindicate the premise of my question, I want to stress the unexpected, often shocking nature of successful social movements. No one sees them coming. Lenin was stunned by the success and speed of the Russian Revolution. Now pause over that. Lenin, an architect of the Russian Revolution, had no idea that it would work. Tocqueville, the greatest authority on the French Revolution, tells us nobody saw the French Revolution before it happened. Nobody. More recently, the Iranian Revolution of 1979 was wholly unanticipated. The participants had no idea it could work. More recently still, the Arab Spring was anticipated by the best analysts in the United Kingdom and the United States. And the best analysts in the United Kingdom and the United States are really good. They had no idea the Arab Spring was about to come. It's puzzling but true that large movements, including some that we're in the midst of, and revolutions seem to come in waves. They spread within countries and from one country to another for reasons that remain mysterious. It's characteristic of modern social science to speak of contagion effects, but I wonder if that isn't a metaphor rather than an explanation. It's not literally contagious. It's not like the flu. It's contagious in some metaphorical sense. So what does it even mean to say that a social movement is contagious? I'm going to try to approach these questions, and my strategy is going to speak generally and abstractly, and I hope the points will map on to whatever social movement you're interested in. And then we're going to talk a bit more particularly about hashtag MeToo, on the theory that we're in the midst of that as well, and that it's an instructive case study in how social movements happen. I hope the relationship between hashtag MeToo and some seemingly very far afield movements, including Brexit and the movement for gay and lesbian rights and the movement for animal rights, all these will be transparent. Okay, I have four moving parts in this approach. The first is preference falsification, by which people often do not say what their inner self is crying out. That's the story from Syria. The second moving part is diverse thresholds, and I'm going to explain that momentarily. The third is interdependencies, which is not about sentiment and Christmas, but instead about how what we do and think is a product of what other people say and do and think. And the fourth and final moving part is group polarization, which helps explain how like-minded people go to extremes. For starters, with respect to preference falsification, most of us have a bunch of thoughts inside our heads with respect to our workplace, our town, our family, our country, that we tell nobody about. Some of those inner thoughts we might be ambivalent about and think they're probably wrong. Some of them carry clear conviction, but as in the case of the Syrian computer programmer, at most we will whisper them. We falsify in the public domain what we think privately. Second point is that different thresholds for action mean that for some of us, injustice and we're there. If we see something awful, we will say something or do something instantly. Others have high thresholds. They have to be really roused. With respect to interdependencies, the suggestion is that most of us are reactive to what other people say and do. If one person is doing something, calling for social change X or Y or Z, we might think, crazy person. If 1,000 people are, we might think, why didn't I join them yesterday? The group polarization point is a simple suggestion that often our preferences and beliefs are fortified and intensified if we're talking to like-minded others. And that can create a kind of social whoosh, that's the technical word, W-H-O-O-S-H, exclamation point, when like-minded people talking to each other end up in a more extreme position just because they're like-minded people talking to each other. If we put these points together, the difficulty, indeed I'd say the impossibility, of anticipating social movements becomes far less puzzling. We don't have to talk about contagion and influenza. The four factors just discussed, I'm going to suggest, tell us somewhere between 90 and 98% of all that we need to know to answer the puzzles with which I began. Okay, now I'm going to elaborate a little bit. As a law professor, most of our articles end up in footnotes. You know, 7,000 word articles, 18,000 words of footnotes. Here are some footnotes. Okay, people might say they like the status quo. It might be connection with the European Union. It might be gender practices. It might be something involving freedom, or it might be something involving democracy or not. They might conceal what they actually think. They might say they like the existing regime when they hate it. They may shut up. Their friends and neighbors might have absolutely no idea what they actually think. That means that people, all of us, live in a world of pluralistic ignorance in which we are unaware of the preferences and beliefs of others. Under oppressive regimes, preference falsification is common. But even in democratic regimes, it's pervasive just because of the power of social norms. My favorite book on Nazism, and I use the word favorite because it's engaging and in some ways fun as well as instructive, is a book from long ago, maybe the first book that was based on actually talking to Nazis, the 1950s, called They Thought They Were Free, by a journalist who went to Germany after the war, tried to figure out what Nazis were thinking, and found he liked everyone he talked to, said they became friends. And one of his friends said the following, speaking of the views of ordinary people under Hitler, asked about, did people oppose Hitler? And here's what the journalist's Nazi friend said. Opposition? How would anybody know? How would anybody know what somebody else opposes or doesn't oppose? That a man says he opposes or doesn't oppose depends upon the circumstances, where and when, and to whom, and just how he says it. And then you must still guess why he says what he says. That's an offhand set of oral comments, and it's deeply profound about what makes social change frozen or what makes it possible. For those who want to predict revolt or movement, the problem is that social norms or law can draw a wedge between private preferences and public statements. The law really matters if people can be punished. Maybe they will be shunned, maybe powerful people will do something bad to them, maybe their employment prospects will be compromised. In any of these cases, people might not merely silence themselves, they might say they are happy with the status quo when they're not at all. Recall the chilling words from the computer programmer in Syria. Now turn to diverse thresholds. Different people need different levels of social support before they will rebel or say what they actually think. And this is an effort to put a little micro foundations on the bones. Can you put micro foundations on bones? Or is this a terrible metaphor? To put a little skin on bones of the idea of bandwagon effects. And this very much bears, I think, on what happened in Brexit, actually on both sides. Some people might require no support at all to say or do something. They're rebels by nature. They might be courageous, committed, or foolish. Let's call them, not as a pejorative, just as a description, the zeros, because they don't need anybody else. They might well turn out to be isolated. Nobody at all may join them. They may be out on a street somewhere with a sign in their hands, in which case they might look nuts or radical or ridiculous. Other people, and this is more common, require at least a little support, they're not going to move unless someone else does. But if someone else does, they're prepared to speak or act as well. Call them the ones. Can you see where I'm going with this? This isn't extremely mathematical. Do you know who's coming next? Others require more than a little. They're the twos. The twos aren't going to do anything unless they see the zeros and the ones, but if they do, they're going to rebel also. The twos are followed, not amazingly, by threes and fours and tens and hundreds and thousands all the way up to the infinites, defined as people who will not oppose the current situation no matter what. Now here's the kicker. Outside of science fiction, it's not possible to see people's thresholds. Each of us may not ourselves know whether we are twos or threes or fours of tens, and it may be issue dependent. We might find in the next month or year or decade that we are, with respect to issue X, threes or sixes. Who knew? But once there are ones and twos and threes and fours, we're right there. The American Revolution, which is kind of signaled by this amazing institution where Benjamin Franklin visited, is a case study in the effects of zeros producing signals that activated ones, and then there were twos, and then there were threes, and who knew there was going to be a revolution as a result. That brings us to the point of interdependencies, which point to the fact that the ones and twos and threes behavior depend crucially on who and if anyone is seen to do what when. To make this clear, suppose that various citizens, this is a very stylized description of how social movements work, are in a kind of temporal queue. They're in a line, and the line is not spatial, it's time. The zeros go first, then the ones, then the twos, then the threes, and so forth. Then we're going to have a rebellion or a movement. It's all going to work. But only given the right distribution of thresholds and the right kind of visibility. If the ones see the zeros, they'll join, and if the twos see the ones, they too, and if the threes see the two, the conditions are just right, and it's going to work out. But the conditions have to be just right. If there are no zeros, or if no one sees any of them, the status quo is going to prevail. The status quo or the regime will be safe. That suggests the interdependencies signal the possibility that society will move very dramatically or not as a result of serendipitous or random factors. What exactly happens when? And my tentative suggestion is many historical movements which we deem inevitable and a product of the arc of history or the movement of culture is actually about the ones and the twos and the threes and the fours and who did what exactly when. Okay, the last of my moving parts is group polarization. We have preference falsification, we have thresholds, we have interdependencies, and here's the last, group polarization. I did a little study a while ago in which I got a group of people who were kind of worried about climate change, talking about climate change, registering their views before they talked to each other about climate change, and then registering their views after. The basic finding is that before they talked to each other, they tended to like an international agreement to control greenhouse gases. After they talked to each other, they loved an international agreement to control greenhouse gases, and they thought it should be signed 5 days ago. They shot to the left on climate change. In the exact same period, I did the same experiment with people who tended not to be very worried about climate change. Notice how I phrased it. They tended not to be very worried about climate change. They were diverse. Some of them were kind of worried about climate change. They were just the median member, not so worried. After talking to each other, they weren't worried about climate change at all. They thought that the idea that there should be an international agreement to reduce greenhouse gases was crazy. As a result of short period of discussion and in a real world situation, like-minded people moved to an extreme point in which they were more confident and more unified to the left. And the exact same thing happened on the same issue to the right. In the same experiment, I also asked relevant participants to talk about same-sex unions, and precisely the same thing happened. Groups of people who tended to be supportive of same-sex unions ended up, after talking one another, to think that this was the easiest issue in the world, and every one of them thought that. People who tended to be skeptical about same-sex unions ended up being extremely skeptical of same-sex unions, and every one of them thought that. In their anonymous private statements of view, that's group polarization in action. And I hope you can map on the group polarization phenomenon to what's being observed in this country with respect to Brexit, and what's been observed in the United States with respect to immigration, and what's been observed all over the world with respect to climate change and sex equality. Okay, now the kind of resolution of a puzzle, I hope. Why are large-scale movements or revolutions so hard and maybe impossible to predict? First, we don't know what people's preferences and beliefs are. By hypothesis, they can't be observed. Second, we don't know what people's thresholds are. They too are unobservable. People may not know their own thresholds. Third, and I think most decisively, we can't anticipate social interactions. Who will say and do what and when? Even if we could identify people's preferences, for example, by looking at Google searches, and even if we could figure out their thresholds, which I think is really challenging, we still wouldn't be able to know in advance the nature of social interactions. These points suggest that even if, with the aid of new technology, it's increasingly possible to identify private preferences, we still will have a very hard time predicting social movements. We might know that people are very upset about something, and that will be informative. Secret opposition may be necessary for a movement, but it's not enough. No one has the prescience to know who is going to interact with whom and see what and when. This helps, I think, account for the tentative suggestion, which is social movements, including the election of President Trump, various things that are happening in various nations right now, are unpredictable because they're often a product of serendipitous, random, or seemingly small factors of who did what when, who heard what at what time, and whether some kind of butterfly flapped its wings at the right moment. We might think that practice a practice, or a regime, or a policy, was bound to fall, but it really wasn't. It happened to fall. The same is true if it doesn't fall. It happened not to fall. Okay, this is a simple account, and I want to just make two supplemental points to complete the general picture. First, consider some words by way of contrast with the Syrian computer programmer, these words from a woman in North Korea. It never occurred to me that I could or would want to do anything about it, where it is the current situation. It was just how things are. Now, what I want to highlight here is her precise phrasing. It never occurred to me that I could or would want to do anything about it. That's her phrasing. It's not about self-silencing. It's about desire. The suggestion that she introduces is that sometimes people don't have a voice in their head suggesting something's wrong. The voice is uniform. It's coherent. People don't have to work to shut themselves up because their preferences, their wants, are adaptive to the existing practice. fully adaptive preferences in which people think it's fine, it's furniture, it's not a practice that might be different, are an extreme case. The North Korean woman suggests a real case, but an extreme case. It might be better to speak of partially adaptive preferences in which people think that something is wrong or bad or horrific, but the awareness takes the form of a small voice in the head to which people aren't paying a lot of attention. The idea of preference falsification isn't adequate when people's preferences are an artifact of the status quo. The second complication is the very word preferences is misleading, I think. It might be better to speak of people's beliefs, experiences, or values. Under an oppressive regime, people might believe that terrible things are happening. They are also concealing or falsifying what they prefer, but that's not an adequate account of what's happening. They're concealing or falsifying what actually happened to them. That's fake news. Okay, now I'm going to try to be more concrete, and I'm going to use Me Too as an illustration of the points. And again, the hope is that this can map on to any number of social movements and help clarify something that seems like an inkblot, a mystery. Preference falsification. Here's a common refrain from participants in the hashtag MeToo movement. I had an experience, it may have been in the 1970s or 1980s, but I wasn't going to tell anybody. Or I was subject to a practice that was horrific, but I took it as part of life. As I say those words, thinking, this is spontaneous, I confess, that the first time I talked to my mother, who's no longer with us, about feminism, and when people were working on it, and I was keenly interested in it, and I talked to her about it, her initial reaction was very negative. She said, you know, why are you thinking about it? You're a constitutional law guy. Why are you thinking about this stuff? Why are women obsessed with this? And I kind of spelled out what feminists were saying, and there was an extremely long pause from her. And this was not a woman who was prone to long pauses. And she said, words I'll never forget. She said, God bless you. And in those words, which were said with much more feeling than I mustered in my recitation, was clear a host of experiences in her own life that she had not told anyone about. And that was preference falsification. In many cases, victims of sexual assault and sexual harassment, mostly women, but many men, including, I'm sure, many men who are in this room or listening to this, have said that all is or was well when it was anything but that. What was kept private was a set of beliefs and preferences and a set of experiences alongside very acute judgments about those experiences. We might want to speak in this case, as in many others, of experience falsification, which can be a product of a lot of different social factors. It might be a product of a rational calculation of costs and benefits, given the risks of disclosure. That's about preference falsification. Second, different women had and have different thresholds for disclosing what happened. Some are ones, others are twos, others are tens, and others are hundreds or thousands. For one reason or another, some are infinites. We're never going to be hear from them. They might be scared. They might have loyalty to the perpetrator. They might cherish their privacy. They might not want their lives to be disrupted. Some might not have clarity on what their thresholds are. Here are words from Beverly Young Nelson, who accused a Republican Senate candidate called Roy Moore of assaulting her in 1977. I thought that I was his only victim. I would probably have taken what he did to me to my grave had it not been for the courage of four other women who were willing to speak out about their experiences. Their courage inspired me to overcome my fear. Third, social interactions are crucial to hashtag MeToo. Under certain conditions, the threes and fours would silence themselves because the ones and twos were silent too. But MeToo has benefited from the visibility of those who spoke up and the multiple interactions made possible by social media. Here's a statistic for you. Within 24 hours of initial tweet by an actor, Alyssa Milano, who used the hashtag MeToo as a call, within 24 hours, 45% of all Facebook users in the United States had friends in their networks who had posted with hashtag MeToo. Once the ones and the twos spoke out, the threes and the fours felt safer and more emboldened. The rise of hashtag MeToo is a case study in what happens when preferences that have been falsified are unfalsified, and it's also a case study in what can happen to adaptive or partially adaptive preferences. With respect to them, the mechanisms of change aren't adequately understood, but there's no question that as norms shift, preferences can unadapt. And that is part of what is happening here. Okay, I'm almost done. My major emphasis has been on the voice in the head, which for better or for worse, starts emerging as social norms soften or change. But it must be added that that is has a sibling, which helps explain a large number of social movements as well, or which accompanies the kinds of social movements that I've been describing. And what I'm about to say bears directly on Brexit both ways. Many movements, including hashtag MeToo, are not only about the revelation of suppressed preferences, experience, beliefs, and values. They're also about the transformation of all of those things. So what we observe in addition to unleashing is altering pre-existing beliefs. Any social movement casts a new light on past experiences and tells a new narrative about them. It doesn't merely elicit pre-existing judgments. It produces novel ones. Part of the success of social movements that accomplish what they aim to is to turn a sense of embarrassment and shame into a sense of dignity. Okay, I'm going to end with the quotation from the computer programmer from Syria, and I hope it will be seen in a somewhat different light now. When you meet somebody coming out of Syria for the first time, you start to hear the same sentences, that everything is okay, that Syria is a great country, that the economy is good. It'll take like 6 months, up to 1 year, to become a normal human being, for people to say what they think, what they feel. Then they might start whispering. They won't speak loudly, but eventually they will. Thanks.
Thanks, Cass. So we've got about 25 minutes. I've got a few questions and then we'll open it up. By the way, if any of you were sitting there thinking, how did he get all those ideas into one book? He got all those ideas into one chapter of this book. So when I tell you at the end to buy it, you really ought to, because it's mind-blowing. So one of the things I love about that account, Cass, is that it's a bit of a poke in the eye to big data, isn't it, really? Because the kind of big data enthusiasts, who are like the early sociologists, like Saint-Simon, I mean, you know, the founders of sociology, they genuinely believe, they call it social science, because they genuinely believe that you would be able to predict social movement in the same way as you can predict the movement of atoms. It's poppycock, isn't it, really? I mean, you know, you can have all the big data in the world, but you ain't going to catch the fact that a butterfly flapping its wing is going to lead to a social revolution.
Completely. So there's a question which is related to what you just said, which is, why is it that experts can't predict cultural success very well? Harry Potter was turned down, I think, by 12 publishers. How, that's their business, to make money, sell books. They didn't know. How can this be? And the big data just doesn't tell you. And studies of cultural success and failure suggest that if you get a bunch of early popularity, if someone says this is great and tells someone else and tells someone else, then the thresholds can add to social interactions, and then you can have Taylor Swift. Now, she also happens to be great, Taylor Swift. Can we agree on that? but her greatness is not sufficient, and you couldn't predict from data crunching that Taylor Swift would become Taylor Swift. It's butterflies and who is talking to whom exactly when.
And in fact, I guess, whilst people are saying, well, big data makes it easier to predict, the way, the speed with which information moves actually makes it less easy to predict, because a phenomenon like Me Too can, 45% of the population can be wherever within 24 hours. And, you know, pre-internet, at least you could kind of sort of see this stuff happening in real time. Now it's happening at the speed of light.
Yes, no, that's great. And I think probably we want to distinguish between those social changes that depend on social interactions, which are, I think it's too weak to say there's an empirical challenge we're not able to meet. I think it's right to say that there's a conceptual problem that we're never going to be able to meet, which means we can't predict that. Now, whether someone in a population is likely to commit a crime, big data is kind of helpful on that, or whether a student is likely to do well in school given certain characteristics. So there are some prediction problems that are more tractable now than they once were, but there's an important class that involves social movements where we probably can do a bit better. We know from Google searches some things about what people care about that we wouldn't otherwise know. And that can give us clues, but not laws.
Brexit. Sorry. just on behalf of my country, I just want to apologize to you as a visitor for... I'm interested in the relationship between dry firewood and sparks. So a claim that is made on both sides of this argument is, if I don't get what I want, there will be blood on the streets. Yeah, and it's particularly, I think, made at the moment by the kind of Brexit group. And part of the reason it's hard for Remainers to have blood on the streets is they tend to be kind of soggy moderates on the whole, so they're just not kind of more likely to riot, whereas Brexit people on both extremes are slightly more inclined to. But nevertheless, both sides are saying, if I don't get what I want, that will be the spark that will set off the dry firewood of people's rage about either the fact that we're leaving or the fact that we might stay. What is the relationship between dry firewood and spark? I mean, because my kind of suspicion is that these people are kind of, if it doesn't happen spontaneously, they're going to try to make sure it does happen. So there's a bit of this which is not so much I'm predicting something as I'm threatening something.
What I'm thinking as you talk is that when people threaten something, you know, very grave, usually they're feeling humiliated or disrespected. And the threat, it may be credible, but it's expressive of a sense that they haven't been treated with dignity. And so one way to address people, children and adults, and they may have legitimate reasons, it doesn't even matter that much whether they have legitimate reasons for feeling disrespected, that it's kind of charitable and probably right to think they do. And then to meet them where they are, which is there, rather than on the threat. So when I was in Washington, there was one member of Congress who was especially agitated at President Obama, and for a period he was kind of terrifyingly agitated at me, and there was something I did that really bugged him, and I didn't mean anything by it, but he felt it was showed him a lack of respect. And just because he was a human being and an elected representative, I apologized to him. And I'll never forget the expression on his face. It wasn't gratitude, it was amazement. It became gratitude second, but it was, you're apologizing to me? You're treating me with respect? And that was, you know, of course, he was elected representative, and the fact that he was a different political party from me, that didn't matter. I had done something which he reasonably thought was disrespectful. I think that's the way I would wonder whether it might be useful to go at people who are threatening something horrible.
But I guess what I'm getting at as well is the sense that, in a way, your book is about the fact that social movements, but there's also a kind of interesting thing about when social movements don't happen. That is to say, when the conditions might be right for it, and there's no question that a lot of people are very angry, they're probably angry enough to be on the streets, but it's still going to require a moment when people actually do go out there. And it's, the Gilets Jaunes is a great example of this. You know, I think the French are kind of constitutionally even more pissed off than we are, generally speaking, and they have a fine tradition of going onto the streets. But nevertheless, it took a couple of people writing a couple of things on the internet that went viral, and then people putting on the yellow vests for this social movement, which now seems to be petering out, but to go on for months and months and months.
Right, so history is only run once, which means we won't see the counterfactuals, which are the social movements which are successful and with us, petering out. We don't see that. And we don't see 1,001 social movements that could have been successful that weren't, that, and we don't see what would have happened. And it's often a small thing that works in stopping them. Now, if an institution that's seeking to stop a social movement is smart, it will be alert to these various factors about group polarization. And there's a terrific research paper on China's approach to dissent by a political scientist named Gary King, who worked with Chinese government, which was pretty open with him. And roughly, what the Chinese government does is, if on social media people are saying the government is doing bad things, they don't censor that. That's fine. They might put a lot of material in suggesting the government is doing good things, but they're not going to stop people from complaining. But if someone says, we're all going to meet in X location on April 28th, let's come and get together and plan, that's censored. So there's an evidently keen awareness that there are possible interactions and polarization effects that are threatening.
Just to draw back for a couple of last questions before I open it up. One of the other American friends of ours that we've been delighted to welcome here over the years is Steven Pinker, who's spoken here 3 or 4 times. Now, Stephen, as you know, his kind of general view is that the arc of history is benign. And many of the social movements you talked about, in the end, are liberatory movements. They are movements in one way or another trying to fulfill the kind of notion of human rights and human freedom. What about the reverse, though? Do you see, how real do you think is the danger of a kind of a reversal of that, of a return to more oppressive, less tolerant societies? Or, I mean, I think Pinker would say you can't put the genie of freedom and tolerance back in the bottle. They can have temporary setbacks.
Well, 2 + 2 can't equal 5. That seems right, yes?
We'll give you that one.
But you can...
Possibly in the House of Commons.
So what I'm thinking is Professor Pinker, whom I greatly admire, he can't be saying that it's a logical impossibility. It's not like arithmetic. Which is, this is my colleague, I'm kind of politely disagreeing with him. So I say I disagree with him that surely a regime could get more oppressive. There's nothing in the structure of the universe that means that Russia has to be more democratic in 2019 than it was under Boris Yeltsin, or that it has to be more democratic in 2028 than it is now. And we could say this about the Philippines or Poland or Hungary or any number of countries. So the genie in the bottle, that's like contagion effects. It's a metaphor.
But Cass, those are predominantly movements led by populist autocrats. The very notion of social movement seems to imply liberation. It seems to imply participation. That's what I'm getting at, is social movements that are reactionary.
See, I gave examples that were often ones that I think many people would consider good, civil rights movements and such, but I meant to include Nazism for a reason. And there's nothing necessarily benign about, okay, so I gave you the study from Saudi Arabia. Here's one from the United States that isn't doesn't have quite the same valence. If you ask people whether they want to contribute to an organization, I'm going to make it a little more dramatic than it actually is, but basically this is what it is. Give to an organization that hates immigrants. You want to do that? A number of people do. Do you want to do it publicly? No, I'm going to hide that. Then remind them in a randomized experiment, President Trump, he's president, by the way. Then they don't care if it's anonymous anymore. Then they say, oh, he's president, I can do this. Which is to say, just that anti-immigrant sentiment, which I don't love, is unleashed by an understanding that the social norm has weakened. So I guess this is a way of saying that the word social movements is agnostic on whether the movement is a desirable one or not. Now, on the progress of history point, the great behavioral scientist Amos Tversky said, I'm an optimist, which is not only a tribute to his sunny character, but he said that I'm an optimist because it's rational to be optimistic. If you're a pessimist, you suffer twice. And that's quite right. So the only note is to say that there's inevitable positive movement either from public participation or from astonishing, in some ways, success of democracies in the 20th century is that's unearned optimism.
So finally, and here I draw you back to your wider thinking about change and about government. And by the way, there's a fantastic review by Cass of a book in the New York Review of Books at the moment about governmental dysfunction, really, the way that government and other corporations stand in the way of people exercising their rights and entitlements. We have a phrase we use here at the RSA because we think a lot about change. So we have a phrase, and that phrase is that we encourage change makers to think like a system and act like an entrepreneur. So to understand problems systemically, but to try to act in a very agile and adaptive way. Now, what we find is that very few people disagree with that, actually, as a count. The difficulty is that our governments, our institutions, are not set up to think systemically and act entrepreneurially. They're set up to act in silos, they're set up to be risk-averse, path-dependent. You're somebody who goes around the world encouraging kind of innovative ways of thinking about government being better at doing what it's doing, using evidence better. You know, our own behavioral insights team is all based on your kind of work, and that's a good example of innovation. Tell us where you think we are, in 1 minute, on kind of government getting better at behaving and other institutions in behaving the way you have to behave in order to achieve change.
I loved your term about thinking systemically and behaving entrepreneurially. That's fantastic. And in Europe, there's a lot of movement in that general direction, I'd say. I don't want to make, you know, global statements because there's a lot of sclerosis and siloing. But the interest in two things is palpable. One is evidence, testing, rather than, you know, speculating. And that's been a kind of very quiet revolution. No one has a banner or a test that would seem to be like about academic standards or something and punitive. And who would march to that? But test for evidence, that would be, you'd think that's a boring banner. But people are marching under that banner, actually, in governance. We're seeing much more empirical work. I've been relatively recently in the Netherlands and Denmark, Sweden and Norway, and the idea of being entrepreneurial in Germany, in thinking about government initiatives, it's more palpable. I think that at any time in ever. And it might be just because learning on the part of public officials is, if not exponential, it's going up. And so you're seeing extraordinary innovation. Some of it's really quiet. And it might be about something like highway safety, where Sweden has something called the Road to Zero, which has been spectacularly successful. There aren't headlines, but it's just what you say. They're entrepreneurial, but they're thinking in systems.
Great, that's very encouraging. Okay, let's take some points. We'll take a few if that's all right. And here. And then the lady in the third row there.
My question is, thinking about the technology that we have today, the social media, etc., doesn't that have a major impact on the first two of the four factors you talked about? It is now possible for some idiot in Norway to influence somebody going into Christchurch. So that ability to know, if you like, that there's other people like you is now just simply quicker. And the second one then is about the ability to then polarize, because the internet can actually be fragmented and you can therefore get people hyped up and divided into, whether it's media or anything else, matters that reinforce the polarization. You get to hear more people who think like you and talk like you, and you're not exposed to people who don't. We're going to go through an acceleration of this based on the elements that you've defined.
It's a completely...
Hold on to that. I know the second point. I know you're going to disagree with the second point.
No, I like it.
Although, interesting example of the first point is the Flat Earth Society. It ceased to exist, but it's now recreated itself. Because there weren't enough Flat Earth societies and believers in any one place. But it turns out globally there's sufficient Flat Earthers for the movement to be back on its feet. So there we are.
Hi, I was just wondering what it would take to falsify the theory you just presented, because it seems like when I think about it, you can kind of, either situation, you can kind of explain away. Like, the Me Too movement actually started 10 years earlier by a black woman, but then never spread the same way. But then you can argue, you can still kind of justify that and fit that into your theory.
Karl Popper is channeled into the room. Falsification is the key test. Yes, absolutely. Here we are.
Yeah, I'm still so stuck on the question of the Tinder that Matthew sort of came across to you on. This switch in norm or weakening of norm, the potential change in the threshold, they seem to be agnostic, and that worries me, to truth. Okay, it wasn't the Norway question to me as much as it could be anything. Right, the speed of light kind of issue on information now means you appear to be able to get that social movement going without any care. The utopian in me wants to think they will die if it's not true, but I haven't got there yet. So I wanted to know your view on the falseness or truth of the instigation.
Great, you got. If you answer those in the next 2 minutes, we can have one more round.
Okay, I think I can. So, agreed entirely on both of your points, that the internet is, for many users, an echo chamber, what was once called a daily me. It's the daily me. I can hear people like me, who might otherwise be hard to find. So the idea of tribal creation or division being fortified by the internet, that's an extremely important challenge for social media platforms. Facebook has been thinking about it, and they should think about it. With the idea that you can see other people quickly, and that can mean that the ones and twos are visible in a hurry, that's absolutely right. And both of these are potentially good for desirable movements, but also literally horrifying for others. That's completely right. I think the falsification could happen if someone said, you know, on the basis of what we know about web searches, here are the social movements that are going to happen in the next few years, and I can predict that. If those predictions turned out to be true, my account would be extremely vulnerable, because I'm arguing the strong version is that's not conceptually possible ever, and the weak version is it's an empirical challenge that we are not foreseeably going to surmount. So that would falsify that claim. On the truth point, I'm going to say something kind of liberal in the sense of the liberal political tradition. Maybe, as Samuel Johnson said about second marriages, that they are a triumph of hope over experience. So that's what I'm going to say about truth, which is that the marketplace of ideas is imperfect but real. So that if you have a challenge to an existing norm that's based on, let's say, a factual falsehood, or that's based on what is appropriately described as false, even though it's not quite a factual claim, like the inferiority of people of certain, the moral inferiority of certain people. I think we could describe that as false, even if it's not literally a factual claim. Even with the social media problems, the fact that falsehoods can be challenged from within, that is, in the fullness of time, I guess I'm aligning myself with Pinker here, better than helpful.
Mind you, as Cain said, in the fullness of time, we're all dead. So, yes. No. Ah, oh, yes. Ah. Oh. Yeah. Is this a tweet? Very good.
Yes, this is a question from Twitter, from Catherine Hobbs. How could we encourage intelligent disobedience as a healthy, accepted norm to move us towards humanistic beliefs and values?
Awesome. Here, and then in the back row, and that'll be it, I'm afraid. Yeah, great. And then there's a woman in the back row.
Thank you. A question about the Industrial Revolution. You can see it as sparked by the profits of the sugar trade in the Caribbean. You can see it affected by technological developments in cotton spinning and cotton weaving. Should one also see it as a social movement?
Brilliant. I remember a very long Melvin Bragg program about precisely that topic, where he got very angry because he didn't. Right, anyway. Right, yes.
So you said that we can't predict social change, but do you think that the combination of data, big data, social media, behavioural insights, does that mean we can be more successful at creating and manipulating them, even if we can't predict them?
Ah, good questions these, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, fantastic.
Right, you've got 2 minutes.
Okay, so on the creating social change, absolutely. So, and we kind of know about what can be probabilistically helpful. If you tell people that there's a movement that's emerging in the direction of X or Y, that can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. And people are very alert to that, either because they know behavioral science or because they have a sound intuition. Some really cool recent data suggests if you say there's a norm out there which is in favor of something, that increases compliance with that norm. That can be a lie. There might not be a norm out there. And if it's a lie, it might be exposed. But if you can't do that, if you say there's an emerging norm or more people are, that can sometimes be true. And the data suggests with respect to sustainability, that's extremely effective in moving behavior. So I'm not sure if manipulation is too pejorative a word, but influencing behavior, absolutely. These are clues, as suggested, about how to stop things, which the Chinese government is alert to. And I think all governments should be alert to how to stop bad things, and also how to produce things that are good.
And we have, by the way, we have a negative example at that moment, which is that the media keeps saying that lots and lots of young people carry knives because they're worried about other people carrying knives. And whether or not it's true, it's catastrophic in terms of the message.
I heard that actually no one's carrying knives.
Yeah.
Not even one person.
Well, that's exactly what
we
should be saying.
To be the
that
only
is exactly
person
what we should all be
knives.
Saying. No one carries knives.
No one exactly. is carrying knives. The Industrial Revolution, I think the great Albert Hirschman had something to say, which suggests an affirmative answer to your question, is it a social movement? And he was speaking really about markets, but the Industrial Revolution is a terrific case in point, where Hirschman's claim is, with markets and industrial development and such, there's a softening of social ties such that you think of one another as potential trading partners rather than people of different ethnicity and religion. And that can create what, my French accent is amazing, so I hate to brag, but du commerce. Are you amazed by that?
Yeah.
Amazingly awful. But du commerce is the French term. It doesn't even sound French. But for the softening of social norms, and by some people who were thinking about and participating in the Industrial Revolution, that softening of social antagonism was part of the valued byproducts of the industrial development. On the great question about intelligent disobedience, I have a complicated answer, which I'm going to just give the kind of punchlines on. Strong presumption against disobedience if it's disobedience of the law. So you're hearing from a lawyer. So intelligence disobedience is across a large terrain, an oxymoron. Intelligent obedience, obey the law. That's not in my contract, but That's what we lawyers think. There are cases where civil disobedience is justified. It would have to be basically an extremely strong moral commitment that can't be achieved through any other mechanism. Nobody should be hurt by it. There should be a willingness to take the consequences and mostly try to find other ways.
So I'm not going to be creatively disobedient by letting us go on beyond our closing time. Let me just precipitate two social whooshes. Almost everyone in this room is going to buy Cass's book, so you may as well just join the gang. It's available outside, both his books and his new books, and he'll sign them. And also, everyone in the room who isn't a fellow is going to become an RSA fellow, so you may as well succumb to that as well. If you want to know more about the RSA and our work, please go downstairs to our Rothmore's Coffee House for lunch or coffee. You're going to bump into other fellows, staff members there. You'll find out about the wonderful organisation that is the RSA, and do go and get this book. It's a wonderful book. But for now, please join me once again in thanking today's terrific speaker, Cass Sunstein.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.